Today's talk, the title of today's talk is Views and Opinions. I'll start by reading something from Joseph Goldstein. This was the first Dharma book I ever read, The Experience of Insight. I still keep going back to it 25 years later, so it says something about it anyway. He's talking about how we get attached to our views and opinions and how this is a problem. The second great attachment is to our views and opinions. We have so many opinions about things, so many preconceptions. Attachment to view is such a great bondage. It keeps us from seeing how things are and filters reality through the colored glasses of our own particular conditioning. A great meditation master from Thailand, when asked what was the greatest hindrance his students had, answered, "Opinions, views and ideas about all things, about themselves, about practice, about the teachings of the Buddha." Their minds are filled with opinions about things. They are too clever to listen to others. It's like water in a cup. If the cup is filled with dirty, stale water, it is useless. Only when the old water is thrown out can the cup become useful. You must empty your mind of opinions. Then you will see. It's pretty clear. I like how straightforward he is. If we let go of this attachment, the whole Dhamma will be revealed. Everything will be there. We have to let go of our preconceived ideas of how things are, or how we would like things to be, or how they should be. Letting go of our attachment to our cherished opinions. The key word there is cherished, I think. It's like not only do we have views and opinions, but we cherish them. We think they sort of become our identity. In a lot of ways, it's like I'm the person who believes this or thinks that or belongs to this group or whatever. And it gets in the way of seeing things clearly. Because they, as the image uses of colored glasses, the English phrase looking at things through rose-colored glasses. So it could be green-colored glasses because you're envious of something, or black-colored glasses because you're always thinking those people are bad, or whatever it is. Pick your color. But we have to be very aware that we all, without exception, me included, have views and opinions about things. How things should be, what's the right way to do something, pick your ideas. And the problem with views and opinions is they seem so natural. It's like, well, of course it's that way, or, well, that's how I was taught, or that's, everybody knows that. When you hear yourself saying in your mind those sorts of words, that's when you have to pause and go, oh, gee, is that just a view and opinion? Is that just something I believe because that's how I always believed, or I never really thought about it? I just took it in because that's how I was brought up, or that's how my political party thinks, or how my, men's group thinks, or whatever. It doesn't matter. Pick your way of getting views and opinions. We all have them. And so, how do we form our views and opinions? How do we get them? Well, partly, like I said, it's cultural. Partly, it's how we were brought up, our family structure. Partly, it's our national identity. Partly, it's, pick all the different ways we identify as something, right? The Buddha, there's a very famous sutta, which is what I want to do a lot of, spend it a lot of time talking about. The Buddha would go from place to place, He was a wandering sadhu, right? Except during the rains retreat, they would all gather in one place. But the rest of the time, all the monks wandered all through northern India, and actually more than that, eventually. And at one point, when he came to this village of the Kalamas, and this is called the Kalama Sutta. It's quite famous, actually. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I want to read two sections that are germane to what I'm talking about. The Kalamans, who were inhabitants of Kesaputta, sitting on one side, said to the Blessed One, "There are some monks and Brahmins, Venerable Sir, who visit Kesaputta. They expound and explain only their own doctrines. The doctrines of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. Some other monks and Brahmins too, Venerable Sir, come to Kesaputta. They also expound and explain only their own doctrines, and the doctrines of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. Venerable Sir, there is doubt, there is uncertainty concerning them. Which of these revered monks and Brahmins spoke the truth, and which faulted? Venerable Sir, there is doubt, there is uncertainty concerning them." So, think about the diversity of opinion about how things should be in the world today. You could pick 10 different isms if you started digging very far. And they would all say contradictory things, and often they would do exactly this and revile and despise them. Oh, those people are wrong. I know what's right. And so their question is that was relevant then, is just as relevant today. It's just as relevant today. And Buddha gives this very concise answer. It's this answer that I'm going to pick apart. "Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what is required by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon a bias towards the notion that is being pondered over, nor upon someone's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, the monk is our teacher, Kalamas. When you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things shall lead to benefit and happiness. Enter and abide on them." So this is quite a list, right? And it's all the ways we fall into the trap mentally of clinging to an opinion or clinging to a view of things. And see if some of these seem familiar to you, because they certainly some of them certainly have always seemed familiar to me. First one is acquired by repeated hearing. And this is that, these politicians love this one, actually. If you say something enough times, people start to believe it's true. Right? So just because everybody's saying it doesn't mean it's true. Doesn't mean it's valid. Doesn't mean it's anything other than it's something that someone's saying. But because it has that sort of mass appeal, that sort of general acceptance out there, that must be true. That's the one place we get caught. Right? Mm-hmm. Tradition, number two. This is the thought in the mind where you say, "Oh, it's always been this way." Right? Tradition is just that. It's like the habitual pattern of a group of people you're connected to. Doesn't mean it's right. Doesn't mean it's anything other than, it has tradition can be quite useful. It has, some socially binding value. And it's can feel connected to your community or your family or whatever. Traditions can be a good thing. But the problem with tradition is we start to believe, this is the right way. This is how it's got to be. Everybody knows that, right? That's what tradition does to us. We start to think that It's the correct way, as opposed to, it's just the way my family does it, or my church does it, or my community does it, or my country does it, or whatever. Pick your variety of tradition. But that's all it is. It's just something that's, we've fallen into the habit of believing and accepting as the way, right? Next one is rumor. I heard it someplace. Have you ever caught yourself doing that? Like, you sort of, oh, I heard this someplace. And the modern version of this one, by the way, is this, I saw it on the internet. Because you saw it on the internet, it must be true because it's on the internet. So it's like so much of what we see out in the world today falls on under into that one. Well, I saw it on the internet, therefore it must be true, because the internet is like a massive, global, wise thing. In fact, that most of what's on the internet is total nonsense, is beside the point, right? But it's because, that's rumor. It's like, it's a form of repeated by hearing, but it's like, it's become something people sort of, did you hear? It's like, because like almost gossip. It's gossip related. It's like people hear about things through people chatting to them about it, Scripture number four, because it's in, it says right here in the Bible, so it must be true. It's my scripture says this is true, therefore it's true. Or it could be the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita or the Pali Canon, the Sutta Bari's yakking about. It's all just scripture, right? It's just stuff that, it's a special form of tradition, and because it's in what a holy book, it has this extra layer of must be true vibe. And of course, this is, this particular one gets abused so often. Because there's this one book in the gospel, in one of the Paul's letters to the Corinthians that says homosexuality is bad and you're all going to burn in hell, people can go, see, it says right here in the Bible, this is bad, therefore, end of discussion. It's a discussion ender. It's in the scripture, therefore, that's it. Because this is God's revealed word, right? It's just such a dangerous place to go. And once again, scripture is wonderful. I love the Pali Canon. I also have a great love for the Bible. I spent a couple of years of my life reading the entire Bible back in my 20s when I was looking for how am I going to connect to the world. And the Bible, I thought, well, I should read the Bible. It's a big book. And there are still parts of the Bible I can probably quote to you, and parts of it I still deeply love. But it's just a view, a teaching based on a particular view of how things should be organized and what's true and what's not true. That's all it is. Beautiful language, wonderful teachings, absolutely. But a lot of nonsense too in any of those books. It's just it's a dangerous combination. Excuse me. So sound really good on my recording, but surmise is the next one. I looked up surmise in the dictionary. To think or infer without certain or strong evidence, conjecture, guess. Well, I think it sounds good. Must be, I like this idea. It's like, yeah, I can go with this one. How often do we go there in our thinking? It's like so easy to sort of, or, well, I got this figured out. without certain or strong evidence, but I've got it figured out, right? Therefore, I know this is true. And then we start acting and speaking from that point of view. Then we have axiom, a self-evident truth that requires no proof or universally accepted principle or rule. That's the definition of axiom. Once again, I went to the dictionary. I love dictionaries, they have all kinds of good stuff in them. A self-evident truth that requires no proof or a universally accepted principle or rule. The problem with these things, universally accepted, right, however, is, well, they're universally accepted in my community or my tradition, but you go someplace else and think, what? How could you possibly think that's correct or true or whatever? It's a different, we think things are universal because it's my universal. It's like that's how a smart people all think or whatever, you know? It's like, but nothing's universal because there's like this, you know what? 8 billion people now. It's pretty hard to find anything universal around 8 billion people because everybody has their own background and their own teachings and their own ideas. So it's a universal within the world that I live in, the mental, emotional world that I'm part of, the society I'm part of. But that's all. That's all it is. It's just something that's, you know, it's. And the thing about these ones is they're sort of a little deeper layer. It's like, you know, they're harder to see because they're so universal. Right? Then this next one, I love this one. Specious reasoning. Apparently good or right, though lacking real merit. Superficiality. Like, yeah, it seems, you know, this is a lot like surmise, I think, but it's once again, it's a sort of another layer of deepness to it because once again, it's become like, because I've thought about it, right? I've actually reasoned this out. It isn't just something I heard on the internet or something that I grew up with. It's like I've given this some real thought. I figured it out. I'm just, you know, and just the fact that we think we figured it out, but it's just superficial. It has no real merit. Okay. Then we have the next one. Bias towards a notion that is being pondered over. You feel you've given it serious thought, but you don't see how you have been swayed by your own biases. It's called clinging to views. This is what we do. It's like, now it's like, I've given this really serious thought. I've figured it all out. I've thought about this a lot. I've read various, you know, commentaries on, you know, this has got to be the truth. And it's because I have a, we don't see the underlying bias that is probably based on some deeply held view of how things should be that we cling to. Another's seeming ability. This is number 9 of this list. You feel that the idea is coming from a person you should believe because they seem to know what they are talking about. It's like, this is a wise person, therefore, it must be true. And there are lots of wise people in the world. And, you know, they all write their own books. But they all have their own views and opinions and their own biases underneath that affect how they speak and express what they're teaching. And if we don't look at that underlying set of biases, then how can we be sure that what they're saying actually is correct beyond, well, this guy seems pretty wise. Which is, and that's, or this shouldn't say guy, this person, because could very well obviously be a woman as well, who's very wise. In fact, probably is more likely to be wise. Okay. And then the Buddha doesn't cut, he's not talking about monks and nuns and all these people who are supposed to be wise, right? Then he says, this person is your teacher. This is the last one. You've taken a person as your teacher, so you should believe what they say is true to be true. You need to be obedient. This is having been in this place earlier on in my life. This is one that can be quite toxic if you're not careful. It's like you've decided you've actually become the student of a particular teacher. And then, especially in some traditions, it's like, well, then, if you're that person's student, everything they say is true. And you have to understand that that's true. It's part of being their student. Total nonsense to think that, but it's what we do. Because this person who's now our teacher is like he or she is special. We put them in a special category. And we do this partly because it feels good to have someone like that who can just tell me everything I need to know and I don't have to think about it because the teacher said it's true, it's got to be true. End of discussion. I was a student in another tradition, and my teacher, his name was Swami Vishnu Devananda, who was a wonderful teacher, and I learned a great deal from him. But some of the things he said, as I started to look more deeply into them, and then after he died, and started comparing and talking to other people who had listened to him, he would say totally different things to different people because it was convenient. He would just like tell people, this is what I know to be true, because he wanted them to do something. He was very wise, but he was also quite manipulative. And that's the danger of this one, is the teacher becomes someone who is in control. I mean, the ultimate level of this is, in the extreme, you have to drink the Kool-Aid, right? And sad to say, that happens all the time. Still, that happens every day. And you see this in different religious traditions and different sort of spiritual traditions and things like that, where this is what the teacher said, therefore, end of discussion. And what I love about this one is this is the Buddha. The Buddha is basically saying, don't believe it just because I said it. This is the Buddha saying, don't believe me just because I said it. What an incredible thing to say. He says, it's just because I said it, or people say that I said it, which is, certainly about what's going on in the Buddhist time. Don't believe it. Don't believe that. It's like, I find that fascinating, And it's like, it's what it says in the sutta, because what does he say? He says, only things you know, when you personally know these things are good, these things are not blamable. In other words, I'm living a virtuous life, and this is part of being virtuous. And I can see it as being virtuous. And these things are praised by the wise. Okay, so that means that, in Buddhist teaching language, that means, other people who have followed the Buddhist teachings, who have also become enlightened, this is what they say. That was the wise always meant. That's what the wise always meant. So these people, not only does it, do I feel blameless? I'm not. I'm being virtuous, practicing and thinking this way. And these people I respect because they're enlightened students of the Buddha. That's what they say. But even that wasn't enough. Then he said, these things lead to benefit and happiness. In other words, does this work? I mean, this is what we have to keep asking ourselves. Is this working? This intellectual sense. I follow this and these instructions. I practiced, and this is what happened. And yeah, this worked. This makes sense because it's part of. It's not just something I believe because it says so in this book, or my teacher told it to me. A teacher told me this, and then I practiced it, and it worked for me. It led to my benefit and happiness. Happiness. Isn't that, that's on the list. It's like, it isn't like, if this teaching makes me suffer and miserable, it's still okay. It's like, it has to lead to my benefit and happiness. This is also important. And then he says, if these things are praised by the wise, these things are not blamable. Undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them. Abide is another one of those key words where it basically means, you abide in an abode. Make this your home. Put your heart there, is what he's saying. That's when you know that you're headed in the right direction. That makes sense. Want to now mention a few other places where you hear about views and opinions. One is in another t of the Buddhist teachings called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind. The last three, three of mind, are covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. In wrong view, we cling to our unwholesome, incorrect views and opinions. We fight to prove that they are right or perfect, and that others are wrong. This is the root cause of unwholesome acts of body and speech. All acts of body and speech come out of wrong view. I know I'm right, so it's okay to whack these people because they don't believe the true religion. They don't believe the correct political views. They don't believe, my understanding of things, right? Therefore, it's all right for me to act and speak in unwholesome ways. Everything comes out of wrong view. And wrong view is deeply embedded in us. And we have to constantly try and be aware of that that's going on, and then try and, if we're mindful, see that these things are there, and then go, oh, I see where that comes from. Can I sort of step back from that? Can I look at this without having that view overlay color my vision? Another mention of view. This is from the third Zen patriarch. The third Zen patriarch is famous for his long list of pithy statements, right? And this is one that I always loved. Do not search for truth. This is a Buddhist teacher saying this, right? Do not search for truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. Do not search for truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. We not only have opinions and views, we cherish them. This is what things. What he's getting at, we hold them really tightly. It's like, oh, these are mine. This is who I am. This is how I identify myself. So a lot of our self-identity is bound up in these habitual patterns of thought that underlie our beliefs. And if we can stop doing that, if we can actually see these things and uproot them, then we don't need to search for truth. You know, searching for truth means that we're trying to figure things out, in a sense. And we're trying, but we're always trying to figure them out in the context of our views and opinions of how things should be. But once we really cut the root of our views and opinions, then everything, and when if we cease to cling to those things, the truth reveals itself all by itself. We don't have to search for it. It's just going to be there. Because it's our clinging to views and opinions that obscures the truth. That stops us from seeing what's already there. So that's why he says, do not search for truth. It's because you don't have to search for truth. Just stop clinging to your opinion, you know, cherishing your opinions. It's an interesting way to look at it, I think. Here's yet another view, so to speak. And this is from Pema Chodron, from a book, When Things Fall Apart. After we have practiced meditation for a while, because we just sit alone with ourselves, doing nothing but being aware of our out-breath and noticing our thoughts, our minds become stiller. Therefore, we begin to notice everything more. But whether we think we're noticing more or not, we really are. So that's the good news, right? In meditation, we allow a lot of space. And then we begin to see whatever comes up with increasing clarity, with increasing vividness. We notice that we're churning out thoughts all the time, and that there are also gaps in all that chatter. We also notice our attitudes about what is going on. Then we begin to be attuned to our habitual patterns and see what we do and who we are at the level of holding ourselves together with opinions and ideas about things. Interesting way to look at it. We hold ourselves together with our views and opinions. When we're not in meditation, we could begin to notice our opinions just as we notice that we're thinking when we're meditating. This is an extremely helpful practice because we have a lot of opinions and we tend to take them as truth. But actually they aren't truth. They're just our opinions. We have a lot of emotional backup for these opinions. They are often judgmental or critical. They're sometimes about how nice or perfect something is. In any case, we have a lot of opinions. Opinions are opinions, nothing more or less. We can begin to notice them, and we can begin to label them as opinions, just to be labeled thoughts as thoughts. Just by this simple exercise, we are introduced to the notion of egolessness. I'm just cutting to the chase here. All ego really is our opinions, which we take to be solid, real, and the absolute truth about how things are. To have even a few seconds of doubt about the solidity and absolute truth of our own opinions, just to begin to see that we have opinions, introduces us to the possibility of egolessness. We don't have to make these opinions go away, and we don't have to criticize ourselves for having them. Could just notice what we say to ourselves and see how so much of it is just our particular take on reality, which may or may not be shared by other people. The most important thing she says is, we don't have to make these things go away. Which is what we start, if we're not careful, we get into this thing of, oh my God, I'm so full of views and opinions, I gotta sort of root them all out and never have a view or an opinion again. It's like saying, nah, I think I want to stop being human. Because if you're human, you have views and opinions, right? It's if we can just see them, if we can be mindful that that's what's going on. If I can be mindful that how I'm seeing something in the moment is based on not on just clear seeing, but on my views and opinions of what I think I'm seeing. My views and opinions are coloring reality over and over and over again. They're basically views and opinions are just temporary arisings in the mind. I mean, really, you're not, views and opinions aren't there all the time. They come and go just like everything else. They arise when they seem appropriate, right? Oh, I gotta figure this out. Oh, here's my context for figuring this thing out, whether this is good or not. But it's just something that arises and then it's there for a while and it's gone, just like every other mental formation. They just have a lot more solidity, or they seem to anyway. But they'll just will go away. We just need to stop cherishing them. And it doesn't mean that they're not going to come again and again and again, but if we can keep seeing them for what they are, then they lose their power. Now they're just, oh, it's like, sort of like your nose itching. Is this something that's there? Oh, look, my nose is itching. It's not like I caused it to be, or it's not my fault. It's just what's there. Can I be that relaxed when my view about something arises and I start to feel myself getting riled because things aren't the way they should be? Instead, I can just go, oh, it's just what, that's what is now. It's okay. And it doesn't mean, I shouldn't act when things are incorrect in the world, or but I have to be very careful that it's not just what I think is incorrect is simply just my opinion, my view of how things are. And that how I see things, in truth, it's just often one view of how things are. Just based on my history and everything else. The Dalai Lama has a lot to say about this. And actually, I'm sure some of you have heard me read this in other contexts, but I love this particular section. This is from his book, The Book of Joy. And the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu are talking about what brings joy in their life. The Dalai Lama uses the terms wider perspective and larger perspective. They involve stepping back within our own mind to look at the bigger picture and to move beyond our limited self-awareness and our limited self-interest. Every situation we confront in life comes from the convergence of many contributing factors. The Dalai Lama had explained, we must look at any given situation or problem from the front and from the back, from the sides and from the top and the bottom, so from at least six different angles. This allows us to take a more complete and holistic view of reality. And if we do, our response will be more constructive. We suffer from perspectival myopia. Not a great phrase, perspectival myopia. As a result, we are left nearsighted, unable to see our experience in a larger way. When we confront a challenge, we often react to the situation with fear and anger. The stress can make it hard for us to step back and see other perspectives and other solutions. This is natural, the Archbishop emphasized throughout the week. But if we try, we can become less fixated or attached, to use the Buddhist term, to one outcome and can use more skillful means to handle the situation. We see that in the most seemingly limiting circumstances, We have choice and freedom, even if that freedom is ultimately the attitude we will take. How can a trauma lead to growth or transformation? How can a negative event become something positive? We are being invited to see the blessing in the curse and the joy in the sorrow. Look at everything, and even if it's like really unpleasant, can I learn something from that? By not just ranting about it or being afraid of it? Can I see it from six different points of view? Because that'll allow me to sort of step back from it and say, oh yeah, but in that sort of way, it sort of makes sense. This is such, it's like Buddhist teaching in action. When we're actually living in the world and interacting with people in the world all the time, can we be this? Can we act in this way? It's much less likely to cause conflict and suffering, both for ourselves and for others, if we can actually be able to step back and have this as, you know, this wider perspective or larger perspective that the Dalai Lama is talking about. So what am I trying to get at here? Mainly simply that we need to have the willingness to always look closely at our motivations and see where our views and opinions obscure clear thinking. What is it, if I can, as I'm about to make a decision, so what is motivating me to think of it in this way? What is it that's pulling my chain or yanking my, you know, leash or whatever it is, however image you want to use, that I don't have to think or act that way. I can act or think, I can still act skillfully, but can I step back and take a long look before I act or speak? Because then what I'm doing will be more skillful and more useful in the world and cause less suffering for myself and for others, which is ultimately what we're trying to do, right? That's what this practice is all about in one sense. It's just, can I learn to be more skillful in the world through my practice and through my understanding from the other practice? Can I then become more useful in the world? One final tidbit here. This is from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In. It's a poem called Willingness. In the willingness to feel, there is healing. In the choice not to closet, cast aside, or deny experience, energy is freed, and I dive deeper into life. There may be maturity in choosing not to act, but there's no rewards for suppression and denial. To be fully alive is saying yes to the wide array of human feelings. When I soften, release, and breathe, I discover I am more than what I think, feel, reason, or believe. Which is often how we define ourselves, how we sense our sense of self is based on what I think, feel, reason, or believe. And I discover I am more than what I think, feel, reason, or believe. And a lot of what we think, reason, or believe comes right out of our views and opinions. It's all wired